This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on remote with John Berry, who lives in Shenandoah, Virginia, and he has so many thoughts and philosophies. I can't wait to share him. Here's John.
Hi, Grace. It's really, really such a pleasure to be here with you. And I can't thank you enough.
We're high on you already. Give us a little bit of you.
Okay. I have a few pieces, very, very short pieces. I wouldn't call them haiku necessarily, but I've been writing this series of poems called The Broken Poem and Other Strange Ideas About God that I actually began writing last year, just a little over a year ago. And included in the series are some very short little pieces. And the series is, they're very much creation myths. And we'll go into more about that in a second. But so I'll start with a few pieces in volume one of The Broken Poem. And I hand make these, by the way, which I thoroughly enjoy. I like folding paper. So here's a little piece. And in these creation myths, rather supernatural forces such as light and darkness and silence and gravity all are very much characters in the stories. So this piece is called Said Light to Darkness. They think beauty is something the world puts on instead of the other way around. This is light's first day, if you can imagine that. I mean, we've all heard the stories, you know, and so there was light, you know, so there had to have been kind of a first day for light. So this is light's first day. After all the hoopla died down, the day of light's creation, and she and darkness were finally alone, they touched and explored each other's bodies, made shadow puppets on the wall, and laughed much more than they cried, making love twice that morning and again that night.
Oh, John. You know, they say that writers are always writing the same things over and over. What are you always saying over and over?
Oh, wow. What am I?
Your characters are there. Are you always talking about beauty? Are you always talking about God? Gravity? Darkness? Are these their themes, do you think, in everything?
I guess, maybe in a certain sense it is. I guess I'm very curious about the who-ness of things, other than, I mean, we always tend to just think of who-ness in human terms, or, you know, with God. But, you know, I'll give you for instance. We have this wonderful old, very, very old American boxwood in our backyard. And she is such a presence, you know, and you can actually, we've actually performed wedding ceremonies inside of her. You know, there's this huge, almost chapel-like room inside this being, you know, and I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, she spoke her name to us, you know, and she likes to be called Eudora, and she's just, I've always been kind of very, I want to be attentive to what's out there. That's not just humanity and, you know, not just reduced to, you know, the idea that we're the only real who's out there. I mean, you know, the who-ness of a river is wildly fascinating to me. And the who-ness of, you know, of gravity, you know, I mean, you know, we tend to think of these things in terms of them being, you know, these forces. And I don't know, I like to think that we miss out on the generosity of these, you know, these wonderful beings that, you know, we kind of take for granted. Well, yes, we do take for granted.
So actually your mission is really a sacred one. I think it is to appreciate and to show, and you have given everything a new name in a way. in your poetry. But what love has started all this? What enormous love do you have in you that generates all of this? And the other things are just beneficiaries of that. So where did you get that?
Where did I get that?
If it's a feeling, then everywhere you go, you just bestow it on people, right? This love of things.
Yeah, I do think that there's, my work is definitely based in the sacred. And, you know, I suppose it's, I think a lot of it really comes from, you know, that, that feeling I've always had that there's something rather than nothing. you know, and I mean, I'll be honest with you, Grace, I've really struggled, you know, since I was a child, you know, just with, it's not an unusual thing, but, you know, but I've really struggled with, you know, the hypocrisy and the dogma and the, you know, the garbage that comes with so much of organized religion. And, but at the same time, I've never been able to let go of that, you know, sense of there being something other than nothing. And I've done the dance of looking for it in different places and in different cultural ideas about God. And I think a lot of, you know, where these books came from was, and that's kind of under this realization that a lot of that really doesn't belong to me. And, you know, the thing that does belong to me, in a sense, it was kind of taken away from me a very long time ago. And even, you know, what was given to me then was, you know, these were very, they were images of God that I wasn't really all that interested in to begin with, you know, and, particularly,
so you started with a very formalized, rigid concept, and you struggle with that. And from that has come this great blossoming of originality in which you express God in so many fresh and beautiful ways. I want everyone to know you have 4 chapbooks, and let us hear a little bit of the broken poem, which is far, I say it is far from broken. It makes, makes us whole.
The broken poem. This was the first piece that I wrote in the series, and I mean, it was totally unlike anything I'd ever written before. I mean, I've been writing poetry since I was a little kid. You know, I took an adulting hiatus from, as a lot of us do. You know, we write when we're children, and we, you know, and then we kind of move away from it for a while because, you know, you have bills to pay and job and all that kind of thing, and. And when I started coming back into it, you know, I was writing what you would consider to be poetry, you know. And so when I started in on this, all of a sudden there was all this dialogue. And I'm like, what am I writing here? I couldn't really decide. It's like, wait, you know, I'm in my same poetic frame of mind. But now all of a sudden there's all these characters and dialogue and everything. So, yeah, it was so very strange.
You just took dictation, let's face it.
Yeah, in a sense. I think that happens from time to time.
Give us the whole of it. Give us the whole of it. And we'll get to know you really, really deeply.
Okay. So this is the broken poem. One day, before there was even such a thing as a day, God was bored. And because music had yet to shape itself in the tap, tap, tapping fingers of God, God began to think of a poem. And because there was only God, except for a lot of silence and darkness, which was also God, the poem went, "There is God." And God stood back and admired the poem, and so invented admiration, not to mention standing back from things. And saying it to darkness, darkness shrugged and said, "Nice." And showing it to silence, silence nodded but said nothing at all. God looked a long time at the poem, which was way before there was such a thing as a long look for a length of time, then broke it in pieces. God handed one of the pieces to darkness, saying, "Here, you keep this." Then handed another to silence, mouthing, "This is for you." the last word God kept for themselves. And God said, now throw your pieces down, which wasn't a thing back then. And while it was a little confusing to darkness and silence, they got the general idea. Throw your pieces down and let's see what happens. God is there, the poem read. A small smile, which always was, washed ashore the face of God. Wonderful, God said, as silence clapped one hand and the eyes of darkness shined. Let's go again. God gathered up the pieces, shuffled, and handed them out. Now, on the count of three, let's toss them as high as we can. One, two, three, go! And the broken words fell for about a billion years like leaves of future autumns. There God is, the words said. Delightful, shouted God as darkness whistled and silence beamed. Let's go again. God shuffled the words. Now, about this time, which wasn't really a thing back then, gravity came by. Curiously dressed and smelling strangely of molasses, gravity held the black hat of future labors in his hands and said, here, drop them in here and I'll shake them. And shook them well, gravity did, and everyone laughed when he tossed them out like flakes of future snows. Is God there? The words blanketed their feet. God looked puzzled. Silence mumbled something inaudible. Darkness looked at his hands. Gravity fell into nervous laughter, as he was known to do, and clutching the black hat of future labors, quickly gathered the words and gave them back to God. Words whirled in God's hands. Come on, baby. Mama needs a new pair of shoes. God was not unused to games of chance. 7 come 11, all God's children go to heaven. God boomed, inadvertently inventing thunder as silence and darkness and gravity made blank, uneasy faces. Is there God? The words clattered like bones and stopped. God quickly snatched them up and, blowing into the nave of their palm, let the pieces fall. Wind, had it been a thing back then, would have held its breath. God, there is, the poem read. Darkness stared. Silence raised a finger to gravity's lips. God looked pleased, as though standing back to admire the solidity of wonder. A feather from the black hat of future labors had fallen between two words, inventing the comma. Well, now, would you look at that? That's a keeper, God chuckled, smiling at darkness and silence, then setting the black hat of future labors back on gravity's head, went about making the world.
Oh, John Barry, gravity smelled like molasses. How brilliant is that?
In my imagination, gravity is, in my imagination, gravity is very fond of making things like syrup, you know, and he has this way of, he likes to talk to the drips of sap, you know, dripping out of the tree
Had the wind been a thing back then, it would have held its breath. Oh, yeah. John, leaves of future autumns. Mm. Honestly, these are absolute jewels, every one of these. It's pretty interesting that people can see this, because this is YouTube as well, John. Mm-hmm. Why are they pocket size, which I adore, because in the 18th century, people used to carry them in their pockets and take a book out and read it. Is that what your wish was?
Well, not exactly. My wife and I have been familiar with the craft of making books for a number of years, you know, and I mean, not that we've really made that many, but we knew how to do it. And that was largely from my publisher with Foothills Publishing, my publisher, Michael and Carolyn Czarnecki, they hand make all their books, and it's in this same style. But when I love Hedgespoken Press is a wonderful press that a fellow by the name of Tom Hirons runs in England, and all his are these little pocket sized books, and I just love them. You know, they're just, you know, and his stories are just so lush and wonderful that I was very attracted to that size. And I really only made the books, you know, just in, I really, as you can tell, I love to perform. So I wanted to have something to put in people's hands. So I was like, well, I can just put two of the stories together in a couple of small pieces, and it could be something I can hand out. You know?
But even more, I think, of the aesthetic is that they are very modest. They're saying, we're not showboats. We're sure you're going to get this. It's like we're little, but we're big. Yeah. And I think there's something about the decorum of a small book, which is a beautiful way of saying, wait until you see how big we really are. We're going to hear more from you. And so it comes from a great passion. Your work comes from a great passion. It could not come from anything else. There's no other source, really. And it is your way of prayer in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say that's true.
Observing the sacred. Observing the sacred. Also, I want everyone to know that you're a master woodworker. So there's something about working with your hands that is very Zen, making books that is very Zen. And it's all, your life is all part, pieces of puzzles that say or are saying the same thing. The interior life is where it's at.
Yeah. Yeah, I really, you know, I sort of float around here, you know, sometimes writing and or working out my shop. You know, I've been really blessed to have I've had a 20-year relationship with the Handley Library in downtown Winchester, which is a beautiful old building. And I've literally crawled inside every nook and cranny of this building and you know, I mean, I do everything from hanging pictures for them to, you know, I just recently built a book drop, you know, a really nice wooden book drop on the inside. And I love my relationship there with them. So I float around from doing little things for them to teaching classes. I love teaching people how to use power tools, actually. And it's really wonderful to be able to teach, you know, kids and, you know, I mean, women, so men, kids, they love this kind of thing.
You are a creator.
I'd love to have more students, I'll tell you that.
Maybe this will do it. You are a creator. So you can create the book, then you create the house to put it in, and then you create the case to put in the house to put the book in. Let's hear some more of the inimitable John Barry from the Shenandoah Valley, Virginia.
So I'll read you a little bit of something from this next story is, this is in the first book, and it's from a story called Gravity's First Day. Again, we were talking about Light's First Day. So this is just an excerpt from Gravity's First Day. And this is, you know, God kind of pops in and out on, you know, gravity doing his thing, you know, and whether he's making syrup or sweeping piles of emptiness and all, but so this is kind of a conversation between God and gravity. From time to time, God visited gravity and enjoyed talking with him about his work. "I see your nebulas are blooming. Lovely," God exclaimed to gravity, who was sitting in a circle of bright young clouds of helium telling stories. "Good morning," gravity said. "That's all for today, children. Next time I'll tell you the story about the mysterious spheres." God smiled, watching the adolescent clouds happily floating away, remembering gravity's surprise when the planets and moons and stars took their familiar spherical shapes. Gravity didn't know it then, but God had a hand in that, a little something to get the ball rolling, so to speak. As for spirals, these were all gravity. "Wow, did you make these?" God asked, knowing full well he had. Being humble as much as loving and kind, gravity smiled and nodded shyly. "Do you really like them?" I was hoping you would. Oh, my, yes, they're marvelous. Top-notch work, God exalted. God loved listening to Gravity chatter on about his work, about the unexpected alliances of salt and the pristine gardens of the earthen mother's flowering crystals, about black holes and the stubborn wrinkles in the fabric of space. God would always nod appreciatively and ask many questions. One day, Gravity seemed particularly pleased. "Say, Gravity, you look like you're about to bust. What have you been up to?" God asked from behind a smile. Always a showman, Gravity spun the black hat of future labors off of his head and set it upside down on the floor. Reaching into its depths, he said, "Remember how we were talking about the weight of things?" Yes, I do. Watch this. Out of the black hat of future labors, Gravity pulled a pound of stone, then a pound of feathers. He held them high, then dropped them to the ground. What? They fell at the same speed. I know. Isn't it cool? Very. The trick is you have to love them all equally. Gravity didn't understand why just then, but God grew very quiet when he said this, then pulled him close and hugged him for a very long time. Thank you, Gravity.
Oh, oh, John, finally we have a playful God. We've had all kinds, you know, but it's because John is playful.
I love to be playful.
And the Dalai Lama, we say, why is he always smiling, you know, with all the pain in the world? Because maybe that's where God lives. In joy.
And in humor.
And you have captivated it. Absolutely. It's sacred, and yet we are laughing when Gravity discovers all these things about the feathers. Oh, that is amazing.
Gravity, you know, in these stories, poems, whatever you want to call them, Gravity is so much innocence there and playfulness. But I find Gravity saying the wisest things, you know, and it just honestly, Grace, you know, there have really literally been times when I'm Gravity will come into a story and I just start bawling at some of the things he says.
Gravity your favorite? That's not fair. Is Gravity your favorite character?
I would say Gravity is definitely my favorite character, but oddly enough, I think I identify most closely with Darkness. And not necessarily for the reasons you might think. Darkness is kind of a little set in his ways.
Well, Darkness gets a bad rap, doesn't it?
Yes, and not in these stories he doesn't. And I actually try to clear a little bit of that up because, you know, this whole association of darkness and evil is really, really, it's not fair. And I don't think it's accurate either, quite honestly. I do delve into that in some of the unpublished stories that are, you know, they're just waiting for me to get around to make a book for them, basically.
You mean that these ideas never stop, John?
No, I've got, at this point, I have enough work basically ready for about 3, 4, 5 more volumes.
Well, please give us some more. We have to have more John Barry.
Well, I'm happy to do that. Something I wanted to share with you is this is a little excerpt from a story called Darkness Learns His Colors. And it's so there's this wonderful love story, really, between darkness and light. And in this story, you know, light is educating darkness about color. And this excerpt begins, it begins with a little description of, darkness tends to be someone who likes to sleep a lot, you know, always taking naps, you know, and falling asleep in the middle of conversations and things. So it kind of begins with a little description of some of his sleeping places. And by the way, just to clarify something, I keep using pronouns here And I do that. I can't tell you exactly why gravity identifies for me as in a male form. Darkness also identifies male. Light and beauty and silence identify in a female form for me. The only character in any in these stories that is specifically has no gender is God. And in a sense, that was a condition that I set on, you know, in writing these, it was also about, I suppose, helping me to repair this long estranged relationship I have with God. And that was kind of one of the conditions that I set, that, okay, well, I'm cool with that, but you can't have any gender. And in thinking back on it, you know, I think part of the exchange in that was that, okay, well, that's cool, but you got to put God in the title, which made me wildly uneasy. But it was also in that uneasiness and that vulnerability. Mm. It kind of told me, it's like, okay, well, that's exactly why you need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Not just for myself, but also for the writing.
I get that.
So anyway, this is from Darkness Learns His Colors. Darkness had often said the abyss was a muscular place that held him like the strong arms of a father, which he admitted was an odd sort of thing to say, considering who he was and how he'd always been. Other places were like soaking in a warm bath, and sleeping under snow, he said, was an excellent way to clean one's dreams. Of late, he'd grown especially fond of those newly invented closets. Oh, yeah, I like this, he said, when the first was made and he tucked himself in the farthest corner, feeling a little mischievous and naughty. Drawing Darkness out of his reverie, Light said, doesn't shade feel different than shadow? It's much the same way blue feels different than green.
Mm.
But let's come back to green in a moment. I notice you shuddered when you mentioned yellow. Does it frighten you? A little, Darkness said, shyly. Darkness thought uncomfortably for a moment, then confessed. I have something to confess, he said. Sometimes when you're sleeping, I watch your colors, and they all deepen, darken under my gaze. All that is but yellow. Oh-ho, doing a little research on your own, are you? Light said, playfully shaking a finger at him. Well, you have my permission. But tell me, why do you think this is? Sheesh, I don't have a clue, he said. It's weird. I look at blue and it goes all nightshade and gloamy. It's still blue, but it's like it's become a part of me. Even orange umbers and red, he said, winking at Light. Well, as you well know, there's no problem there. Light giggled. Oh my, yes, you are becoming quite adept at red.
John, I am enchanted. John, you're writing magic. John, this is different from anything that exists. Shade mm-hmm. feels different from shadow. Before we close, I have to just say that you take the sweetest crystals of thought, and they become the most profound revelations that I hope everyone gets to read these books, but I hope also we get to meet again to hear more of it. So do you have a closing piece for us?
Yes, I do. I'll read you another one of these little short pieces. This is Said God of God. Every time someone imagines me, I take a new form. And believe me, I've worn the godly face of creatures, great and small.
We know who's talking through you, John. Hmm. We know who's talking through you. Yeah. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress with the wondrous John Barry. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, Natalie Canivore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. We thank you. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.